Our Holy Church celebrates two saints tomorrow, rich in both moral and doctrinal meaning. One of them is Job, the righteous Job. We have spoken about him before, and if I have not spoken about him here, I have spoken about him somewhere else, I do not recall where. I wanted to speak about the other one. The other person is a local saint, you might say, of Boeotia. Only those who come from that region know what this saint was, while the rest do not, and what he teaches us through his life. He is known as Saint Seraphim. There is a monastery bearing his name at Dombu in Boeotia, beyond Thebes and farther inland near Chostia, if you have heard of it. It is a very old monastery and observes the Avaton, the rule restricting entry. People will certainly have set out during the night from various parts of Boeotia to reach it. Some, I dare say, will travel 16, 18, or 14 hours by mule, arriving there this evening to keep vigil. Then in the morning, once the divine liturgy has ended, not a soul will remain. Only the birds will be there. That is, the moment the sun rises, you see all the little ridges where the paths run off, and the people leave again since they have venerated the saint and stayed near him for one night. Some time ago I was given the chance to go to that monastery, and I was amazed. Women are not permitted to enter inside. I found myself before a congregation made up entirely of men's heads, weathered by the sun, men of the fields out there, of the countryside, not soft living as we are, sunburnt heads, the church packed full, all of them sunburnt heads. When I came out there to the lectern to speak, he was startled. What is this place? The women had stayed outside. There is another chapel out there, and a priest goes there and serves the liturgy for them. They come with a prosphoron in hand and a few candles. This offering is essential, and on a little slip of paper, their names for the dead they do not write. The people do not know. The name is for the living there. If I recount that whole history to you, there is no need for me to give a sermon at all, because it contains everything. I will put it in its proper place. What happened when I found myself there? I went there again another time, and the people were saying, as I learned, that the man who was there last year would come so they could go again to the festival. Do you understand? All night long, then. 11 priests were hearing confessions because of the evening sermon, prompted by an incident I had witnessed and spoke about. They kept hearing confessions, until in the morning the priest said with fear, the whole vigil had taken place, the liturgy had been celebrated. And he said with fear that there were still people in the line, confessing. This had never happened in all the annals of Hasios Seraphim. Repentance and confession had not been preached, which I did not know. And I will tell you further on, in its proper place, what they did, how the people went there, and how they ought to go. All the chapels, there are 6 or 7 chapels. There are catacombs. I do not know what else there is. Each had a priest and a line outside, and the villagers were waiting to confess. Women, too, with the children they had, the face of the earth was changed. For this reason, pray to God, he has left it to us, to raise up laborers for the vineyards. Let us not ask for preachers. Let us not ask for speakers, so long as we do not pray, and at the same time, so long as we ourselves do not offer. Do you consider it a great thing to give a child to the church? I know a villager who had 7 children, 4 girls and 3 boys. As he tended his sheep, he would pray, "My Christ, is there not one suitable child among mine whom you might call to put on the cassock, unworthy though I am? And I truly am unworthy. Do you not see at least one among them? And do you know what happened? All 4 girls have now become nuns, and in a miraculous way, for they had been thoroughly worldly, not merely intending to remain in the world, but even to become ballerinas. Through this elder's prayers, those 4 girls today are, if not I, for by then weeds will be growing over my eyes. Others may perhaps venerate these young women as saints. And the sons, all but one, came back and have established Christian families, which is incredible. And in the village, they say, 'Do you see that man we used to mock? Look where his children are now. They do not loaf around here and there at the coffee house, nor are they corrupted this way and that, because of the prayer of this father. But these things, as you know, are a joke to us. We talk about how we will educate the child, and in our effort to educate him, we deform him. We deform him in our effort, because God has many of our children among the people whom he has destined for himself. But our own faithlessness that he should not become a cleric, should not become a monk, should not go in that direction, strips the church bare. The aunt interferes, the godfather interferes, the faithless father interferes. The mother, let us say, someone else, sometimes even some cleric, who has not grasped the matter well. And so we are left in the sorry state we are in, and there are no people through whom Christ can speak. Christ does not need anything in himself, yet he asks for Paul's tongue and Peter's tongue, for Paul's feet and Peter's feet. He asks only that a person give himself to him, surrender himself to him, and then Christ has the power to work miracles. What did one monk, St. Cosmas the Aetolian, accomplish among our people during the years of bondage? What did he accomplish? What has he not accomplished? But who will take up this book, read it himself, and then give it to his children to read, so that they may understand what can be accomplished by just one person? A simple man, perhaps even a largely uneducated man, but a grace-filled man, a man who has the grace of God. We want, and tomorrow he will say to us, gentlemen, you gave me nothing. You gave me officers. You gave me chemists. You gave me educated men. You gave me electronics engineers. You gave me this. You gave me that. But for a priest you gave me no one. For a spiritual father you gave me no one. If you had given to me, I was ready. You took charge and created this situation. In any case, so I am going to speak about this venerable Saint Seraphim. I have kept a few notes here so that I may share with you some things about him. He was born in Zelli. That is the name of his village, which to this day lies in the region of Talenti in Boeotia. He was born in 1527. Even as an infant, it seemed that someone was speaking within this child. He was well disposed, and from infancy he was able to distinguish the days of fasting. His parents objected, but on Wednesdays and Fridays he would refuse to take his mother, espresso, and drink milk, just as St. Nicholas had done. He would wait for the sun to set, for Vespers to begin. That is, in a sense, the beginning of the next day, according to the church's reckoning, and only then would he take his mother's breast. So from early childhood it was clear that there was something different about him compared with other children. And this brings me back to what I was telling you earlier. When I went there that evening, the feast happened to fall on a Friday, when I dismounted from the mule. Beneath the fir trees, outside I found, if I say 200 crates of beer, I may be lying. Perhaps there were even more. With instruments professionals, the kind who go and exploit the festival. Goers, pits dug ready and spits, set upright against the pines. The spits were of pine there, ready for roasting. And here at every moment they are going to a vigil. At every moment they are going to a saint who would not eat on Wednesday and Friday. And at a moment when it is already Friday. When I went in, I saw that the courtyard was paved with stone. Perhaps one of you has been there. I do not know. There were a few steps leading up to a broad stone landing. And there, right inside the monastery courtyard, was a man with a young goat. With a knife, he was piercing its thighs and stuffing them with salt, pepper, and garlic. He was preparing it right there inside the courtyard. When I saw all this, I was alarmed. I said, "My God, this whole forest is going to catch fire, and by tonight nothing will be left. Where are we heading? What are these people doing?" So when I went out to speak that evening at Vespers, no one had remained outside afterward. They would eat and drink. The women and a few others would stay for the all-night vigil, while the rest would be drunk, celebrating outside the monastery walls and so on. So when I went out and spoke that evening, I briefly departed from my subject and said, "Please forgive me. I would like to think that you understand. All these people are tired. and there is not a single chair inside for them to sit on. They are standing. A man will have come from far away. One jumps up from a corner down below, 18 hours by mule to come to his grace. So I take this up and I say to him, do you have anything in your sack? Go on, eat then. I have roast meat, he says, and I have cheese. The others were laughing now that a discussion had started inside the church, and I have eggs too, he says. Do you know, I say, the one to whom you are coming? Of course, our fathers used to come and you come as well. But this man, I say, would not take his mother's breast to feed on Wednesday and Friday. How then will the moment come for you to say to him, I don't know what you did, but I am going to eat. I am going to make merry. Did you come to pray? If you are not going to pray, then what do those outside want? Why were 200 and some crates of beer hauled up here? Why are the instruments playing outside? So they know that here the people make merry. They do not pray. They know here that the saint, they do not respect the saint, they mock him. But God enlightened me about all this. I tell you, not one person put a piece of cheese into his mouth. They went home fasting. Not a single bottle of beer was opened. I was showered with curses that evening by those other scoundrels, but not a pipe sounded, not a drum was struck, not an instrument was played. They gathered everything up, put it into the bags on their mules, and took it home, and they ate it on Saturday. From then on, word spread from one person to another, and so forth, and the revelry there came to an end. Now no one goes there hoping to make a drachma. Do you understand? The same thing happens on the feast of St. Nicholas, which always falls during the 40-day fast. If it concerns us, the way he puts it, as for this last thought, if you fasted on Wednesday and Friday, and if you are called a teacher of self-control, then we will accept it, and consequently we cannot take offense. We will set out non-fasting fare. They have plenty of lamb for St. Nicholas. Yes, but I will not give you a blessing so long as you behave in this manner. And this is so not only with these two saints, it is so with the Annunciation, which is a fast. It is so with Saint Spyridon, which is a fast. You will set out what is permitted if you want to have the saint's blessing. Otherwise, you will have the saint's curse. You will not have the saint's blessing. And many people, for the world's sake, drive the saint from the house. Drive Christ from the house. Drive the most holy Theotokos, the Evangelistria, from the house. Because Evangelia and Evangelos are keeping their name day, and there will be meat and the rest of it. So every saint has a lesson to leave to the world, provided the world becomes weak enough to receive it. But we, as you know, even the so-called Christians, do not accept these things. That is why we often say that even in so-called religious homes, Christ is not present. They have his icon, but his grace they do not have, because inside they live their own life. And so Christ has no place there. Since you do not believe me, the proof is that you do not do what I say. Consequently, there is no need for me to be here. I don't know how you take it or what you make of it, but that is how the matter stands. The child expressed this desire to leave for the monastery. The parents opposed it. Do you think it is an easy thing for a man to abandon his games, to abandon the world, to abandon the ball, to abandon his girlfriends, to abandon all this? Is it an easy thing? An easy thing. So for a man to have the strength, on the one hand, to fast from a young age and of his own accord, and on the other, to go far away. They don't take to such things, of course. Not readily. You will call him mad. How is he mad? You want him near you when you ought to let him go an hour sooner, so that you may be rid of him, but he is not mad. He is discerning, and the father becomes a fighter against God. The invitation is sent to the child. His child is called, and he will not give him up. I do not entrust him to you, because that is what it comes to. I do not entrust him to you. I want him here. What would you do with him without me? Whereas I choose him for that calling, so that the people of every age may hold him in account, for there is a chance they will not hold him in account, even in the present age. Of course, those who withdraw from the world to struggle so as to receive the seal of God bear it for all eternity, though it is not visible while they are engaged in the struggle. Until this venerable saint began to work miracles, people mocked him, not only strangers, but even his own family. But when Christ set his seal upon him, and he began to work miracles, then surely, as the saying goes, they swallowed their tongues and bowed their heads in shame. Yet they had fought against Christ. They had become fighters against God. Fighters against Christ. They refused to say gladly, yes. If a king had asked for their child, they would gladly have given him. And they would even have told the whole neighborhood, the king asked for our child, the queen asked for him. But in the opposite case, we do not give him. This is because we are unillumined on the one hand, and on the other we have no inner spiritual cultivation. For many people, when they hear the child express some such inclination toward religion, say with that, my child, the most holy Theotokos grant you her mercy, and Christ as well would that, my child, this thing come to pass. And many times these are simple people who do not know much in the way of letters. Yet they appreciate how the spiritual matter stands against the material, and what eternity means set against what is passing. In any case, these people resisted, as it is recounted in his life. But the child stood firm and spoke to them, and pleaded with them, let me go where I have been called, and if you will not let me go for a time, I will leave at the proper season. The opportunity will be given me to leave, so let me leave now. In any case, it seems he had come of age. The account does not mention that detail there. And he left and went, as was natural, nearby, as it is recounted, to a small monastery of the prophet Elijah, which is about an hour from the village on Mount Karkara. So it says, and there, all alone, he built a little church in honor of the Savior, our Christ, and a small dwelling in which he lived, of these two, the church and the dwelling. The ruins remain there to this day. When his parents learned where he was, they began visiting him frequently and trying to persuade him to change his mind. They enlisted other relatives as well, and so on and so forth, until they forced him to leave that place too. So he gathers his things and leaves from there and goes near Talenti, to a monastery of the Holy Unmercenaries. But from there too he left, because they discovered him there as well. And his parents and the other acquaintances and friends went on scheming to lure him away. And he left from there again, and came to the mountain of Sagmata, Sagmata, to the mountain of Sagmata, there, where it lies between Thebes and Euboea. There is a monastery there again. To that monastery the emperor Alexios Komnenos gave a large piece of precious wood from the precious cross, upon which, as you know, God himself breathed his last for our sake. A great blessing, and he stayed there. There the monastery was a men's house. The abbot esteemed him, and so on. Now far from his own people, he was lost among others. He was not yet a monk, and they made him a monk, then a deacon, and afterward they made him a priest. But his virtue became known, and now people, and even strangers from elsewhere, began to go and visit him there, and he left from there, wanting to escape it, because, you know, if you do not have strong breaks when you receive daily congratulations and praises, when they beg you to bless them, to pray, and so on, your mind, as the saying goes to your head, and there is a chance that you fall from a height you could never imagine. To hold firm in all the other cases, and yet to fall through a hidden self-importance, that you are something. That is why it says he left from there and came west of Helicon to Dombus, as it is called to this day. And there, in secret, he again built a little church in the name of our Christ and a few cells, and many began to gather there. But right beside it there was a settlement, as we used to call it, of Albanian families, wild people. Even the wild beasts were afraid to pass through there, let alone people settling. And you can understand how hard a thing it was for this man to stay there. In any case, by his prayer and by a good word, he managed to disarm them and to give them tools so that they would now work the land. Over time he softened them, and he stayed there 10 whole years. After 10 years, Christ spoke to him and told him that he had to leave that place and go down to build a monastery that in the future would benefit the people more. Christ commanded him to build a monastery, not a sanatorium. The world can build sanatoriums. No, the world builds hospitals too. He was to build a monastery concerned with people's souls, not their bodies. And indeed, he went alone to a place he thought might be suitable. But he had not chosen a good spot. It was a shaded, hidden place, and he began to build. When he began to build there, the most holy Theotokos appeared to him in person. And she says to him, "Do not build it here. Build it near the village of Dombas." The village then was made up of just a few farmsteads, of course, humble dwellings. He obeyed. In truth, those people ought to have offered to give him land, but they did not give it. And he looked in a roundabout way to find them the money to, so to speak, buy it back from them, to pay them. Yes, that word is not quite the right one, but in any case, so as not to wrong them, to give each one whatever he thought he could fairly get for the little house he had, for a small field, and so on. And he paid them, he compensated them, he compensated them all, and they withdrew. And so there he built a monastery. But this was a difficult thing. To secure it firmly, he set out and went to Constantinople, to the patriarch, who gave him a written permission, which survives to this day, the permission of the patriarch of that time. And he built a Stavropigial church, as it is called, in the name of the Savior. And it was exactly where the Most Holy Theotokos had directed him that he would build the monastery. But the people do not consist only of good men. There are cunning ones among them too. Those were the years of Turkish rule. These things were happening around 1560 to 1600 or so. And you would not be liberated until 1800. So certain cunning men, what did they do? They went down and denounced him to the chief of the Turks in Livadia, saying that the monk had deceived the villagers there, taken their fields, and driven the people from their homes. When the Turk heard this, he sent 3 soldiers to bind him and bring him in for further dealings. When they came up, instead of doing exactly what their commander had told them, they struck the man on the head, and his head split open, and blood began to flow. They reviled him in their own way. They cursed him. They left nothing sacred or holy untouched in their way, those Turks. In any case, in the end they bound him and took him away. As they were returning, they reached a place called Pambukloi, or something like that. They were terribly thirsty. And then they struck him again because, they said, he was the reason they had been sent up there and had had to go through all this ordeal and were now thirsty on account of him. When he heard this, he said to them in his own simple way, "Do not be distressed. If you wish, let me go, untie me, so that I may pray to my God and refresh you with a little water." And indeed, faced with the need of their thirst, they untied him and he prayed. And with his staff he strikes the ground, like another Moses, and water came out there, which exists to this day. And it is the saints of Giasmos, his holy water they drank, and perhaps filled their flasks too, as we used to call them, the way you soldiers carried them, but they were still harsh with him, even though they had seen that they were not dealing with an ordinary man, that something more serious was at work in this person. In any case, they moved on, and a little farther down they came to a place where they met doves, and they began firing their guns to shoot the doves, but they hit none. They cursed in their own way, and then he tells them, "Do not be distressed. Wait a little, and I will help you catch a dove." Indeed, they halted again in front of that other church they had seen earlier, and the elder prayed and stretches out his hand, and 3 doves come and settle on it of their own accord. "Take one," he tells the first, "take the other." He tells the second, for there were 3 of them, "Take the other." He tells the third, they were left with their mouths open. This second miracle forced them to let him go and turn back. Such things were happening. But, to make a long story short, he became a great and renowned figure in that region. In any case, he foresaw his own death, that he would soon depart, and there is a beautiful account of what followed. He called together all the disciples he had there and gave them his final counsel. I would not call these commandments, although at one point he says, I give you this commandment as well. Rather, they were words of counsel, a sacred legacy entrusted to them. When I read it, I wept, not over the content. I wept for this reason. I say to myself, this man was not married, while many today are married, and some willingly have no children, and others, though they had children, in effect have no children, for at the hour of their death they have nothing to say to anyone. And we see fulfilled, I say, in this very case, what Isaiah says, that the children of the desolate woman are more than the children of her who has the husband. A man bereft of a wife to have children, as do many indeed many nuns who are abbesses in certain monasteries, where you see them with 10, 20, 30 girls beside them, though they have no husband, and so this is fulfilled. How many, I say, of our own people would want to have someone of their own near them at the end, and they do not have it, they do not have it. How sad a thing this is! And he, by contrast, you now see around him a whole swarm, all of them hanging on his lips, Father, and so on. All in tears, because they are hearing his last words, because they know they are dealing with a holy elder, and the holy elder knows that he is surely about to depart. Compare our condition with his condition. Many repent afterward, when they have neither spiritual children nor even children of their own flesh, because they wanted to live their own life here. They put Christ beneath their feet. They were indifferent, and they pay the price for it. But their pride won't let them admit what they truly feel. Go, if you like, to the so-called nursing homes and meet people who have no children. The ones who had a single child or two, only as many as they themselves wanted, see how bitter they feel today about that choice of theirs. And the others who thought, I'll live my own life, and so on, yes. But old age comes too. And what then if you stayed young forever, you could live for yourself? But later on, wouldn't you want someone to be near you, someone? To have someone comfort you, to say something to you, to offer a word of consolation. This is a great thing, though we may not realize it. He, as I was saying, foresaw his death, called his disciples together, and entrusted to them his final counsels. So listen to what he told them. My beloved children, the time of my earthly life has come to an end. It is finished, not coming to an end, but has come to an end. It is finished. I have fought the struggle entrusted to me by the Lord as best I could. He does not say I completed it, but as far as I was able for my part as a man. There is humility here, and that is a great thing. It remains for me now only to die once, as everyone must. Do not grieve that I am departing from you, that I am leaving your side, but rejoice and be glad, because we have completed the work that is meant to remain upon the earth, to the glory of the name of God the Most High. We completed it together, all of us, not I completed it, I finished it. He sets them forward. He sees them as his fellow workers, both in the material things and in the spiritual. This work, this very work, will remain, and it continues to exist to this day upon the earth, to the glory of the name of the Most High God. Do not forget the teachings you received from me, a frail and weak man, your spiritual father, not a professor, and never abandon the spiritual struggle of Assisi. Do not say, I am fine now. Until your final hour, you will keep struggling, as far as you possibly can, watching in every direction. And this is true, because Paul says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. For through this, and this alone, a person can sail across the storm, tossed sea of this present life. He calls it a sea. There will be waves, there will be storms, there will be shipwrecks, and there will also be times of calm. Yet through this, as though upon a raft, as though aboard a vessel, a person can reach the long for heavenly harbor. If a person does not struggle spiritually, he has no raft, no vessel, no means by which to cross this sea. Indeed, do you know what Saint Isaac the Syrian calls this life? A mire-filled sea, a filthy sea. That is what this life is. And blessed are those who will cross it. Prayer, my beloved children, is the sweetest conversation with the heavenly King. It becomes spiritual nourishment for the soul, and through it the door is opened toward the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, do not forget prayer, lest you be deprived of that sweetest communion with God, for abandoning prayer is the spiritual death of the soul. Indeed, a person who does not pray is spiritually dead. Prayer is the oxygen of the soul. When a person does not pray, it is as though his spiritual lungs are diseased with tuberculosis. Prayer restores a person's balance, drives away Satan, purifies the nous, the spiritual intellect, and enables him to see things differently. It comforts him. In prayer, he finds something to lean upon. Prayer is indispensable to him, especially in a life filled with so many difficulties. Do not let private cares alone swallow up your soul. Only what we will build, what we will do, what we will expand, what we will deposit, what we will invest. And do not let the deadly disease of pride take hold of us. That self-regard that something great is being achieved, which befits Lucifer alone, only the devil carries the sickness of pride. But always be humble and content with little. Content with little. I am reminded here of how once a young man asked an elder, "You speak, elder, about salvation. Tell me, what can I do? What must I keep in mind so that I too may be saved?" And the answer he gave him was this, "My young man, make your work small and your belly small. Take care not to overextend yourself and rein in your belly too, because once your belly opens up, you will look to gather even unjustly to fill it and satisfy it. So make your work small, so that you can keep it under control, and your belly likewise, so that a little time remains for you to pray, to attend to spiritual things, and so that you are content with little in your stomach." So be, he says, content with little and humble, imitating in this our Savior, who had nowhere to lay his head, and who humbled himself unto death, even death on the cross. And indeed, if we had followed the life of Christ, many of us would have avoided many disasters, both spiritual and material. Christ, though everything belonged to him, never possessed anything of his own. His name was never registered in any public office as the owner of property, nor did he even have his own means of transport. He borrowed someone else's donkey to go to Jerusalem. He had no house of his own and not even a tomb of his own. He was buried in another man's tomb. In short, he endured all this and deprived himself so that we might have these things, but at least let us have them in moderation, not in excess. For much of what we possess beyond our needs is not lawfully ours. Such excess cannot stand before the justice of God. Yes, it will pass through the river of fire and be utterly consumed. Therefore, we must take care to regard as our own only what has been honestly earned by our sweat and our blood. Everything else belongs to others and will ultimately bring us harm instead of benefit. One more command, he says. Here he uses the word command. I give you, and I ask you to carry it out. He now gives an order before. These were requests, now it is an order. And this order concerns him personally. And what is the command, you know? It is not, put these slippers on me, notify such, and such bishop, place me there, and so on, the sort of instructions our vainglory gives. Rather, he says this, when my soul departs from this body, take my body and bury it at the old monastery, where the most holy Theotokos, all holy, was revealed to me, at that very place where the most holy Theotokos, all holy, was revealed to me. And let the place remain unknown. Do not say where you buried me, where my grave is, so that in this way the crowding of people is avoided, so that they do not even come to my tomb and afterward flatter me. O my saint, you who worked such wonders, and so on. This man, you see, was afraid in a way even of that applause of people after death. We care so much, so very much, to learn what impression we made. Our clothes, our child, our song, where our name is written. This man feared such vainglory even beyond the grave. When he no longer belongs to himself, he belongs now to the church. It belongs to the forgiveness of Christ, and Christ will arrange to make him known to people so that others too may benefit, which of course Christ did for him afterward. But he said it into his testament in the last minutes of his life. I beg you, I command you, if you esteem me, respect me, and value me, and if you think you receive something good from me too through Christ, grant me this favor. Do not bury me in a place the world will know, so that even in death I may avoid being made conspicuous. Such standing out is a serious thing. Blessed are those who keep their heads down. Blessed are such people. And you know, we are inconsistent. Go to a battlefront, and you will push others ahead and hide behind, perhaps even behind some rock. But here it is the one who lifts his head up, the viper who does not fear the spiritual war. For just as in material war, which takes off all the heads that stick out, that thrust themselves forward, so it is also in the spiritual war. If a person has a virtue, some knowledge, a talent, or anything else, he should give it to God. My God, it belongs to you. It belongs to God, children. It is not mine. What I have told you is his, not mine. But we present these things as our own. And that is where pride does its damage. This is what the elder said before he fell asleep in the Lord. He died in 1602, on the feast of mid-Pentecost, during these days. At the sixth hour, 12 noon, at the age of 75, if anyone wanted to recount all the miracles he performed while alive, and later after he had fallen asleep in the Lord, he could write and speak for months on end. I have gathered just a few examples, both from his lifetime and after his death, so that you may see what he did, for instance. While they were building the monastery, and this testimony survives to this day, they were quarrying stone above it for the construction. A huge boulder, 10 meters high and of unknown width, broke loose and began tumbling downhill. It would have left nothing standing, not only the monastery, but nothing at all. And he is just in time, and they are just in time, and they cry out to him, Father, and he is just in time, and cries out, Most Holy Theotokos, help us. And the stone stops, and it hangs there to this very day. This stone, you see, even though it may be 30, 40, 50 tons, it rests there as if someone had propped it up from underneath. And it stands there menacingly, just as another stone stands above the monastery of the Great Lavra, no, of the great cave at Calavrita up above, ready to fall down, and yet it does not fall. Just as another one does, down in Arcadia at another monastery, ready to fall, and yet it does not, not with an earthquake, not with anything. The standing, the classic miracle is this one, which remains to this day, the one he worked while he was alive. Also, while he was still alive, they brought him a demon-possessed boy from a nearby village called Chostia, which still exists today. The boy's name was George. They also brought him another demon-possessed boy from his own village, Zeli, a fellow villager. Both children were suffering greatly, and he delivered them from the demon. While he was still alive, he also worked the following miracle. A swarm of locusts surrounded the monastery. He did not go outside, but they came and told him, You know, Geronta, we are overwhelmed. Everything outside has turned black. The locusts have left nothing. And he went outside with his staff, raised it in the air, and made the sign of the cross. Then that whole cloud of locusts lifted up, flew away, and fell into the sea. It vanished without a trace. This was yet another miracle that took place during his lifetime. They had beehives outside the monastery, and a bear, a she-bear that had appeared, kept going and eating up the hives like this. The monk in charge of that service there reported to him, This and that, fine, he tells him. Go to such and such a place, and skin her, and bring us the hide to the monastery. The monk did not understand this, but in such cases he rendered obedience. What did I say to you? Go to such and such a place, skin the bear, and bring us the hide here. So in such cases, when God brought up the day He went off there in obedience, and he sees the bear lying dead on the ground, and he draws his knife and skins her, and brought the hide to the monastery. And to this day, a piece of that bearskin remains in the monastery in remembrance of the miracle. Grace has preserved it. The rest was eaten by various people, one taking a piece for a blessing, another doing the same, until they left nothing. And since people knew the miracles the saint had worked there in the region, it happened that once in Piraeus such a plague of locusts fell. Piraeus was not as it is now. There were a few houses. Now it has filled up to the very last edge and the last hill. The result was that some Christians who knew the saint had worked a miracle at his monastery petitioned, and they went and brought his holy skull to Piraeus. And when the priest of the monastery who had brought the saint's holy skull raised his hand and said, "Save, O Lord, your people," before anything else could happen, that whole cloud of locusts rose up and went and fell into the sea. And out of gratitude, the people of Piraeus have built a church to Hosioseraphim, as a remembrance of this very thing I am telling you. Now there were Turks here in Marusi, a Turkish lord with a very large orchard, and he suffered the same damage from the locusts. They were eating his crop, even the bark, not just the leaves, the bark too. So he summoned his own priest, Muhammad's priest, and the priest went there, their own, to exercise, to read in his own way, in the name of the Prophet Muhammad, to be delivered, just as the Christians did. But not that time, not a locust gone, nothing happened. A Christian in those days had learned that the saint's holy skull had come here to Athens, and he goes to the Turk and says to him, "If you want, my lord, to save your orchard, summon the Orthodox priest, the Christian, to bring something, and you will see the results." Driven by the despair of losing all that labor, he accepted and summoned ours. And when he entered, when the saint's holy head was brought into the orchard, all the locusts fled, and the Turk's property was saved as well. These things, of course, reveal Christian goodness, the love of Christians, and of the people of God. The Turk then gave a great deal to the monastery. At the same time, he seized his own priest and gave him such a beating that, if he is still alive, he remembers it to this day. He beat his own priest. Of course, the Turk did not repent, change his life, or become a Christian, but the priest certainly took a beating. Also, there is another fine one, very instructive. When we pass through Chostia on the way to the monastery, or when we return, we pass through a field which is still called the monk's field. He had given an order to the monks that wherever they happened to be, when they heard the bell on Saturday evening for Vespers, they would leave even their work half done. They would abandon it and go. This field for one to go down to the monastery is about 3/4 of an hour. An hour that much it would be, that much it should be. So then on a Saturday evening the monks had gone and were working over there. They heard the bell at the monastery, but they saw there was one corner still left, an hour's work. "Come, let us finish this part too, sew it, so that we do not have to come back here a whole day, to a different spot. It is something reasonable as men." So in this case they stayed back a while and finished it. He saw that they had not come to Vespers. When they came back, "What happened to you? Why did you not come to Vespers?" They said, "Geronta, this is what happened. When the bell rang for Vespers and it was time to prepare, we still needed another hour. Why lose an entire day? We decided together to stay and finish it so that we would be free to move on to another larger plot." "Do you not know," he says, "that whatever you work during the hour of rest is accursed? Do you not know that God worked for 6 days and on the seventh he rested? Do you not know that whatever you put together with the days of labor that comes from the time of rest will be lost and will defile the rest as well? Go, and never do this again." So on the Saturday evening, he said, Sunday morning after church, he mounts the mule, "Get the mule ready." We mount the mule, we go to where you were sowing. They go to where they had been sowing, where they had been in the evening sowing. In which part? So this man said, "Here, this piece, put markers here," he tells him. and he puts markers, stones. I do not know what he put. He separated off this piece. Nothing else. That was that. They go to the monastery. The matter rested. Harvest came. The next summer it is reaped. When they first reap in the field. My disciple, set fire to this, he told him. Let this part burn. But how could he set it on fire? A fire in the summer would spread all the way to Albania. What are you saying, elder? He asked. Should I really set it on fire? Set fire to what I am telling you. This cannot be gathered together with what is blessed. It is accursed and must be burned. But he would not set it on fire. Set it on fire, the elder told him, but still he did not. At last the elder compelled him, and he set it alight, and the fire behaved as though it were a rational human being. It crept along and burned everything that had been set apart, without touching the other pile, and without spreading into the surrounding wood, where it might have started a wildfire that would still be burning from the blaze they had kindled. And it remains there to this day, and everyone who passes by is taught something, if they are willing to be taught. If they are willing to be taught, we, on the other hand, give no weight at all to such things. Even our own laws, the ones we have made, are lawless, and you can understand what happens in a case like that. Another fine example, one that can be of use, shows that when a person belongs to God, he has nothing to fear. Two men were riding their horses to the monastery to venerate and to attend the services. Now along came a Turk on his own horse, traveling the road together with them. And he kept cursing the monastery, cursing the monk, cursing the abbot. He was going there to slaughter a goat, to be waited on, to eat and drink and carry on. The others said to him, "This is disgraceful. Show some respect. You do not need to go to the monastery just to eat and drink and behave like a hooligan. If that is how you want to behave, do it somewhere else, not there." But he paid no attention, and they arrived at the monastery. He got down. The Turk went to dismount from his horse, but he could not get down. He tried to dismount, and he could not. He tried again, and he could not. The elder came out and said to him, "Get down." "I cannot," he said. The man was beside himself, pale as could be. He was shaking like a leaf from the trembling that seized him. From what had happened to him, the elder said, "Get down." And when he said, "Get down," he took hold of him himself and brought him down. The man fell at his feet and begged his forgiveness. And from that time he did not merely change, he became an entirely different man. He asked his forgiveness, and from that moment on he did not merely change, he became a completely different person in the presence of the man of God. Just the other day, someone wrote to me in a note, "If someone comes to kill you, what can God not do for you? If I have not sinned, then for him to come and kill me would mean that he had received permission. And if he receives permission, he will come and kill me. But could he come and kill me if he had not received permission?" What did Pilate say to Christ? "Do you not know," he said, "that I have authority," and so forth. "You would have no authority at all," Christ told him, "unless it had been given to you from above, unless it bears the signature from above. You have no authority at all."